Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And this is a place where I've done over 1,000 deeply researched interviews with entrepreneurs about how they built their companies so that we can hear their stories, get to know them, and see, well, frankly, how much we can learn from them that we could apply to our own companies. And I've got a tab here in Google Chrome on my screen. It's a New York Times article that says that investors pumped $1.8 billion into education tech companies in 2014. The interesting thing about that article is where they got that number, a company called CB Insights. Often when you read in the Times or the Wall Street Journal data about startups or venture capital, you'll see that they get their data from CB Insights. Well, it feels to me sometimes like CB Insights is this giant firm that's been around forever, but it hasn't been. Today's guest founded it in 2008. I invited him here to talk about how he came up with the idea, how he developed it, how he evolved it, and how he grew it into this huge company that businesses that we depend on for reputable data like the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and hundreds of other publications all turn to. Anand Sanwal is the founder of CB Insights. It's like Bloomberg for private companies. I invited him here, as I said, to hear how he did it, but this whole interview is sponsored by HostGator. As you listen to this interview or so many of my other interviews, you're probably going to come up with a great idea of your own. The first thing you should do is just put it out there. See what happens with it. And how fast can you get it up there? Well, if you go to HostGator.com/Mixergy, you can get it up there in minutes, and it won't cost you much. HostGator is incredibly inexpensive, incredibly reliable, and as you grow, if you have any trouble, if you need to talk to tech support, they have a phone number you can dial and talk to a real human being who will be there listening, caring, helping you out. HostGator.com. Go to it. Hugely dependable, and I'm really grateful to them for sponsoring Mixergy. Anand, welcome.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me.
I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal, and I'm really impressed. Has your mom seen any of these Wall Street Journal articles? Your family seen them?
Yeah, absolutely. It was one of the first things I did when we got our first mention. I sent it to my parents. I think they were worried, like, what was I doing? Why I left a good job that was paying me well and that was very safe and corporate and established. And so that was kind of like, hey, mom, I'm not just goofing off, and we're doing something that's valuable here. So that was a good feeling. Now I'm going to be sending her this. So now the bar has been raised, but I still try to send her things from time to time that will show her that I'm actually doing something meaningful.
You really are. And hey, mom, the job that you had was at Amex?
Yeah, I was at American Express for 7 years.
What'd you do there?
I was in their venture capital group to start. Venture capital M&A, so mm-hmm. Kind of a big part of why we started CBI was the dissatisfaction with products we had to use in that role. And then I ran a $50 million innovation fund at American Express. Mm-hmm. Again, similar kind of idea, trying to track private companies.
Why was American Express trying to track private companies? What were they trying to do with that data?
Yeah, so when you look at big companies aren't necessarily always very good at innovating. Mm-hmm. And so they're looking at these young private upstarts as either acquisition targets, investment targets, as potential threats. And so tracking them becomes really important, understanding, where the world is going.
Oh, really? They're looking to see who can come after us and what are they coming after us with?
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly.
Okay. And so you were looking online. You were using Dow Jones?
Dow Jones, Thomson, we use a product called Capital IQ, which is owned by S&P.
So give me an example of something you were trying to do that all these great resources, many of them have been around for decades, that they weren't able to do. What's one example of a problem you had that they couldn't solve?
Yeah, so my boss at the time came in and said, hey, listen, we need to understand all the payment startups that are out there that have received funding. Pretty innocuous question. I should, with a couple of clicks, be able to get an answer to that. Mm-hmm. And we went to these databases, the data was different across them. Then we did a quick Google search and saw a bunch of things that weren't in there, right? And so you're paying a lot of money and you're not even able to use the product for what you intended to use it for. But I also don't want to go into a meeting and look foolish, right? I don't want to go into a meeting and somebody says, well, you missed this company, right? And so that level of discomfort with what they had was sort of a initial driver of what we were doing. And then, you know, to be honest, they sort of had this UI from sort of 1983. We thought, you know, there could – people are used to – a better kind of experience now. We could solve that. So better data coupled with usability were sort of the first two sort of tenets of what we're trying to build.
I get that. And frankly, I get paranoid like that too. Before sitting down for an interview, I'm always worried, did I miss one funding round? Did I miss one piece of information that someone forgot to add to the page on Crunchbase?
It's, yep.
Right?
Yep.
And then you miss that one piece of information and all the other work that you've done feels like it didn't happen or loses credibility.
Yeah, it's a credibility. I mean, we sell to a lot of biz dev and salespeople now, right? And the last thing you want to do is call somebody up who's a prospect and say, congrats on your funding round. And they say, what are you talking about, right? Like that's – no matter how good your product or service is, you're kind of dead at that point to them. So yeah, I mean, that's the problem we're trying to solve.
I always wondered what CB Insights stood for. I kind of assumed it was the names of the two co-founders, but in researching this interview, I discovered it stood for something else. What was that?
Yeah, we started off as Chubby Brain. I had bought a bunch of domain names a while ago thinking, you know, sell them or monetize them, and Chubby Brain was amongst them. And yeah, we launched as Chubby Brain. We went to go sell to an investment bank kind of in our very early days, and their feedback was, we love your product, but we will never buy something called Chubby Brain. And our edgy internet entrepreneur kind of you know, credo that we had sort of went by the wayside when we knew we could make some revenue. And so we grew up at that point and became CB Insights.
You're smart. How many domains did you own?
A little over 200.
200?
Yeah.
Because you really are entrepreneurial. You're the kid like me who used to sell stuff in elementary school. What did you sell?
So I was a paper boy. That was probably my first job. I wasn't very good at being a paper boy. And then I had some success in high school selling candy out of my locker. So we figured out, I guess it was some predecessor to Costco, where you could get cheap candy. You'd sell it, we'd sell it, we'd make money. I think it was also sort of, it was forbidden fruit in school to have candy. So I think the risk of people buying candy from us was also another allure.
Yes.
And so that was one of the first successful entrepreneurial endeavors, albeit on a small scale.
Did they shut you down?
Yeah, eventually we got shut down. and then in college, I used to throw parties. So I used to rent clubs and things and promote and made pretty good money, you know, basically selling tickets and, you know. So yeah, that was kind of a lot of smaller enterprises, but good lessons for sure.
You know, I laughed at being shut down, but it's a story that we hear a lot, that a kid will express his entrepreneurial creativity and the system just doesn't know what to do with it. And so they shut you down. Now I understand them saying, hey, you know what? Candy is not really allowed here, but let's redirect your energy towards something that is. How about you sell something like books or notebooks and see if you could do that? They would do that if you drew on your textbook, they might say, hey, how about drawing on a canvas? But you were entrepreneurial. Was your dad entrepreneurial? I heard that you grew up with him making calls to China and India at 2 a.m. Why was he making those calls?
Yeah, so my dad worked in corporate America for a long time. He worked for big French chemical company, kind of realized at some point that, like, he, you know, if he wasn't French, he wasn't going to get promoted. So he left to start his own company. But, you know, really kind of the epitome of the entrepreneur story, you know, no loans, self-funded, took a mortgage out on the house, like, you know, everything was up for grabs kind of. And yeah, he was trying to set up a manufacturing facility in India. And so was making calls at all hours of the night to people overseas to get permits, to get distribution, to do sales, to do everything. So I think that's where I sort of saw the grit and the grind of entrepreneurship and learned it sort of firsthand from him. So that was – it was good to see, you know, kind of firsthand for sure.
What do you mean by the grind of entrepreneurship? How did that help shape the way you think about running your business today, the grind?
Yeah. So, you know, I'm – I know there's a lot of talk about work-life balance and all that good stuff, and I believe in it, and I have a family, but I think we're going to win because we outwork everybody else. Like, I really think that's why we're going to win. You know, I'd love to work 10 hours a week and, you know, do really, really well, but and maybe some people are that naturally, innately smart and gifted. I'm the guy who's just going to work really hard, and I think the team has picked up a lot of that, and that's the kind of people we hire. So,
what's an example of something that you've done that other entrepreneurs might not be willing to do, or the wannabe entrepreneurs wouldn't even know exists as part of the entrepreneurial journey? What's an example of the way you grind?
Yeah, let me think of a good, it's a great question.
I have one that will give you a little bit of time to think of it.
Good.
We had a horrible, horrible connection when we started here. I couldn't hear much of what you said. I said, this guy's going to be so frustrated, he's going to just want to move on because I'm not doing the interview if I can't hear him. And he's going to have to do tech support. Most people wouldn't put up with that. You went out and you got one headset. That didn't work. Then you got another headset that we have on now. Then that headset didn't work. And the reason the headset didn't work is because you needed to install some software. Again, most people would have given up at the second headset or before.
Right.
You got the extra headset, you installed your software, you stuck with it, and I kept looking at you for a sign of frustration, and you were really calm through it all. I think that says a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I look at all of these things like we're talking today as an opportunity, right? A great opportunity. So you're making time for me, so I got to do what I have to do to make sure it's worth your time as well. I think the thing we did early, you know, on that point is, and you mentioned it earlier with the journalists and the media context, was when nobody knew who we were, we reached out to a handful of journalists and said, hey, here's some data, right? And the thing we also did was said, hey, we're going to publish this data, but we're going to give it to you pre-release, right? And so we didn't really have anything, but we said, if there's interest, we'll go develop the report on the back end, right? And so we ended up getting a bunch of interest, not a bunch, you know, 10 people said, yeah, I'm interested in writing about this. We developed a report, you know, kind of after they said they were interested, generated the report, got it out there. And then what ended up happening was they kept coming back to us for more and more data, right? And we drop everything for the media. That's just as one customer. And I think that has been something that's helped us a ton over time. We now have probably close to 500 media folks who regularly talk to us. But, you know, it was a lot of times they, you know, not maliciously, they wouldn't use the data we sent. We spent 2 days pulling something together and it got cut on the, you know, at the final stages. And, you know, it's frustrating, but we knew that this was like an investment, but we kept doing it, you know, and we see somebody wrote about a particular company, we'd reach out and say, hey, if you ever cover this company again, we have some data for you. So I think like we've done a lot of things very manually, very non-tech that are not very scalable, but we just put in the time and kept doing them again and again and again, and some of them have yielded some benefits over time.
I want to break down how you got so much media, who did it, what was your process initially, how you systemize it so that it can be that you can follow up with people properly. But let me go back and understand the data that you were making available to them.
Sure.
The first version of the site was Chubby Brain. It was built as a wiki.
Yeah.
Right? And the idea was, Where initially did you think the data was going to get into this wiki?
Yeah, so initially we thought people would submit the data, and it was sort of wiki meets Yelp, right? So we thought people want to review private companies. Mm-hmm. They really don't, so that didn't work. But then in order to build that, we had to seed the database with some data. And so mm-hmm. we built some software to gather all this data. And we did a lot of it manually again. I think John and I probably did 50,000 articles where we just like an article came out saying, you know, so-and-so raised $10 million from Sequoia. And we would manually put that into spreadsheets. And we did that, you know, another 49,999 times. And so we'd seeded our database. And then
I see one early post here on the site for Woot, the company that was eventually bought out by Amazon. Mm-hmm. What you have here is a review of the company. You have their funding. I'm trying to look in. It's not especially clear, but you show their funding and when they got their funding. Yeah. You have, as I said, a review of the business. You have the team information, you have funding, products and services, competitors, M&A, financials in the news. That's all the stuff that you're hoping to get for them, right? And what you were doing was saying, we want to get financials. We want to get M&A information. We don't have it all. We're creating a wiki where anyone can add it. And until anyone and everyone gets in there to do it, I will, and my co-founder will sit down and we will type into it. That was the original vision.
That was the original vision.
Why do so much? Why not say, hey, you know what? We are only going to do financials. We are only going to do funding. Well, maybe not funding, other people are covering it. But why do all this information, key people, inside info? Why?
Yeah, I mean, I think it was, you know, visions of grandeur as a startup initially, right? And I think we bit off more than we could chew. But what we realized from that was we're pretty good at getting the data on our own. And the wiki aspect didn't really take off, right? There wasn't a whole lot of we didn't really answer the question well for users, what's in it for me, right? If I give you data, like, what's the enlightened self-interest that, why does this benefit me? And so we never really answered that question well. And so when you don't answer that question well, users aren't going to show up and stick around. Okay. But we then, you know, realize we're good at doing this ourselves. Let's just turn to that and just get the data on our own and turn this into a company that aggregates data better than anybody else. And so that's what CB Insights has become. We don't ask anybody really for data anymore. We do have VCs and private equity guys who submit their data to us because they know that buyers of their companies are using us. But most of it now is just algorithmically, I should say, gathered, you know, by software we've built.
It was bootstrapped in those early days?
It was bootstrapped, yeah. So since I came out of American Express, we sold research to the hedge fund industry on the credit card industry, or hedge fund, you know, funds, you know, on the credit card space. So for the first 2 years, we did that concurrently, kind of building CBI in the background, and then.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but tell me more. Yeah. This is, you were going to hedge funds and you were selling them data on the credit card industry as a way of funding CB Insights.
Yeah, absolutely. So
how did you get that data?
We would go to old contacts we had in the credit card industry who now worked at, you know, at American Express and JP Morgan and Barclays and all these other places. Mm-hmm. And once a month we'd do a survey of the about 30 or 35 senior people, and we'd say, hey, what do you think is going to happen in the credit card industry? Hedge fund folks really valued the sentiment that that survey captured, and then they would pay us for it, and they'd pay more than I ever thought they would pay. And you know, so we were selling it for, I think the lowest was $10,000, $35,000, up to $100,000.
And is just a 35-person survey, so were you emailing it to them or calling them up and asking them the questions?
We were calling them. So nobody would put this on – nobody would, like, respond to this via email because they were probably telling us things that, like, their corporate communications folks would get upset about. But they valued getting – we'd send it back to them – the aggregate results. So the people in the credit card space loved it because it was like, hey, what are other people in the industry thinking, right? Without identifying the actual individuals, right?
How did you sell this? I mean, yeah, how did you even know who to sell it to? How did you find the time to make calls?
So we got lucky here. We ran into somebody who said, we sell research to hedge funds. And we said, hey, we have this product. We think you should check it out. He looked at it and said, hey, I think that he's a really smart guy. He said, this is really interesting. I think you guys are early. I think this will be big in 8 months. This is right when the whole mortgage crisis was going on. He said, listen, I think this will be big after people kind of forget about mortgages. For 8 months, we tried to sell it on our own, had no hits at all. We emailed all the alumni from I went to University of Pennsylvania, so a bunch of hedge fund folks went from there, found the alumni database, emailed everybody, got some meetings, but nobody bought. We were about to shut down the company. This is probably late 2009.
This is Chubby Brain. You were going to shut down.
This is Chubby Brain and the hedge fund thing.
And the hedge fund thing. Nobody bought either one.
Nobody's buying. I was paying two guys who we'd hired out of my own personal savings. Mm-hmm. And I was recently married, and it was just, you know, happy wife is happy life. And that was definitely not where I was at that point. Mm-hmm. The hedge fund thing wasn't clicking, and we were about to shut it down, the whole thing, and say, let's just go back to life in corporate America. And the guy, Nick, called us and said, hey, I think it's time for your product. And he started to sort of represent it amongst, and like it just, we were the only game in town for the credit card industry. Mm-hmm. And we knew it had a short shelf life. Like, it was while the crisis was going on. And so for the next 18 months, like, we made hay. And that was enough to fund, you know, Chubby Brain, then eventually CB Insights.
You know, I'm listening to Barbara Walters' audio book, her memoir, and she says that one of the reasons she was able to make so many different world leaders and actors and everyone else interesting is because she got a little bit into their personal life. So I got to ask you, you were just saying that a happy wife is a happy life and things were getting stressful. Can you just add a little color to that? What was going on?
Yeah, so, you know, recently married, I think my wife knew I was wanted to do something entrepreneurial, but left a very good, well-paying job at American Express, kind of climbing the ladder. And I think the stress that came from that was she knew I wanted to do this, but, you know, the implicit thing that comes with founding a startup and not necessarily taking funding, as we chose not to do, was there was a big lifestyle degrade, right? Mm-hmm. It was, you know, we didn't go to restaurants with our friends. We didn't go on vacation forever. You know, and so some of the things that you just became, nothing even fancy, but just some of the things that we became accustomed to had to take a really big back seat. And then more than that, my attention was really on the company, right? It was, I really didn't want to go back to corporate America. And so I said, I'm going to do everything in my power to make sure that doesn't happen. But that required a level of commitment to the company that is tough. I mean, it's tough in at any stage of marriage, but it's, I think, especially tough in the early days when, you know, you're just starting out and you know, you kind of expect.
So what did you say to get a little bit more space to figure it out?
I mean, you know, she has a ton of faith in me, right? And I think I told her when we were thinking of shutting the whole thing down that, hey, listen, like, if things don't recover or get to a point that's reasonable by X date, I'll go back to what it was, right? And so she knew that there was a deadline, and you know, she knew that I was also like way stressed out. So we reached that deadline, and luckily, sort of the threshold that we'd set had been surpassed because the hedge fund thing started taking off. But I think we've kept a pretty clear line of communication the entire time. There's never any surprises, right? And I'm pretty bad about hiding things in general. Like, you can when I walk in the door, you know if I had a good day or a bad day. So even if I was trying to hide it, she would have known. Yeah, you know, we saw things going better. It still took us a while before we took our first vacation, but, you know, the trajectory was no longer going down. Okay. And so that was a big turning point.
So hedge fund thing starting to give you some money, which gives you a little bit of safety and money that you could use to invest in what became CB Insights. You can't make the wiki work, but you are really good at creating your own content. So do you start to put your own content into your own site, into the wiki?
Yeah, we start.
Chubby Brain, you do?
Yeah, we do.
Did you start focusing a little bit more, or was it still going to be all this corporate data about all these startups?
It was still going to be that, but we limited a little bit more to financings and exits, right? So we figured, like, let's get really good at that. And then as we got good at that, we decided we saw people crawling Chubby Brain, right? And so we said, okay, now, like, people are that interested in this. And we had investors reaching out saying, hey, can I get an Excel file or can I get the data presented in this way? So that's when we kind of changed course and said, okay, we're not going to make this public anymore. We'll put it behind a paywall, and will turn into sort of a traditional SaaS kind of software as a service platform. Okay. And then, so in February 2010, we made that transition, sort of we hung the CB Insights shingle out, and that's when we started selling a subscription to the product at a very cheap, I think it was $2,400 a year, like extremely, when I look at our pricing now, it's like shockingly low.
How much would that cost today?
Right now, our average ticket's right around $35,000.
$35,000. Wow, I see a huge difference.
Yeah.
All right, but it makes sense. If it's a wiki, you need it to be public so that people can contribute to it and tell you if you've made mistakes. If it's not a wiki, you can take that data and keep it private and sell access to it, especially since it's you guys who are putting it together. You've earned the right to charge for it. Yep. All right, the data is getting together. Do you remember your first customer?
Yeah, I do. So our first customer, I don't think they'll be upset with me telling them this or telling the world this, was Bain Capital Ventures.
Okay. How did you get to Bain Capital Ventures? That's an impressive company to have as your first customer.
Yeah, so I think a lot of it was the media, you know, using our data, right? And so I think they saw us. The other really good thing about the space we're in is that the incumbent players are really, really bad. right? And so Thomson, Dow Jones, et cetera, aren't very good. So people were always looking for an alternative, and these guys gave us a shot, right? And I look back at the product they bought. It was not very good compared to what we have today, but they gave us a shot, and the benchmark that we were going against was also pretty terrible. So we were able to win their business, in the early days.
So it wasn't you cold calling and getting through to make a sale. It was you getting press, which led to the sale. So let's then go and talk about press. Do you remember how you first went about getting press?
Yeah, so we would go to Google News and type in a term and whatever. It was usually venture capital trends or something. We'd look at everybody who had written about that topic. We'd go figure out their emails, mm-hmm. and we'd write to them and say, hey, listen, if you're covering venture capital trends, we have a really great data source. You know, we'd be happy to help you on any stories, right? We'd also, if we were putting out a report, tell them, hey, in a few weeks we're putting out a report. Would you like to receive it pre-release? If you would, just don't publish anything before so-and-so date and time.
Which came first? Was it, we have this data source, and if you're doing any report?
Yeah, that was the first
thing. The idea was they would contact you and say, we're going to do a piece on how venture capital has grown in the last 2 years in Southern California. Do you have any data on that? And then
exactly.
You would give them that. And then often you wouldn't have data, right?
Yeah, so we didn't have data, or we didn't think it was very credible at times, right? So we would go and kind of scrounge around the internet and try to find it, right?
So then
you would
become their research staff, essentially, going out and finding that data, putting it into your site and saying, here's what we have at CB Insights on this piece that you're doing, hand it to them, and they give you credit.
Exactly. And then we'd ask for a link back. That was like the key thing, right? If some publications don't provide links, but most of them do. And we'd say, hey, can you link to our homepage, right? And then on the homepage, you'd get there and it would say, sign up for free trial. And you'd click the button. And that's what got the machine sort of started, at least.
I see. Interesting. Did you do anything to limit yourself to quality sources or sites that could give you links or anything like that, or people who are within reach?
No, I mean, we did, I think to some degree part of what's worked for us is we didn't target TechCrunch and all those folks necessarily to start. We targeted lesser-known publications, but what we realized over time is the big publications read some of these smaller folks, right? And so if we could be the source of record for some of the folks that aren't household names, the TechCrunches and Mashables and other folks in the world read those folks, and eventually we'd get into their orbit. And I can't say we did it consciously. We just did it because that worked for us. But that ended up working out really well. And so we built some really loyal users of our data, and then they ended up sort of being evangelists for us amongst the bigger outlets as well.
You know what? That's exactly what Ryan Holiday says to do when you're trying to get press. He says, go after the smaller ones. They're easier than the bigger sites. We'll use them as reference points, and it gives you credibility to go after the bigger ones. So
yep.
I guess you lucked into this process, and I can't figure out how you got into it, because I'm looking at your past here. You kind of had startup experience, kind of. You worked for Cosmo. I don't know how many people remember Cosmo, but they used to deliver things like CDs from Blockbuster or from their own cash.
Yep.
To your house, or a candy bar for free. This is in the early days of the internet. You didn't get that experience there. What did you do for Cosmo?
I launched a bunch of their warehouses. So we had warehouses in New York, Atlanta, London. So I was launching the operational kind of infrastructure. And then they eventually sent me to London to launch Cosmo Europe. So there I was fundraising, signing deals with partners, merchandising, the whole deal.
But no press there.
No press,
Did Cosmo turn you off to all startups? Is that why you went back to American Express? You said, this is just a nutty environment. I can't work with these crazy people.
No, I loved Cosmo. I mean, I don't think I've ever learned as much as I did in, a year there. But I had been at PricewaterhouseCoopers and then Cosmo, and sort of, graduating late 90s, kind of thought, hey, I need some stability on my resume. It doesn't look very good to like have a year here and a year here. And so I thought, let me go to Amex. I always thought of Amex as sort of finishing school, right? Stay there for a couple years. They end up treating you well. And so 7 years later, I finally left. But I always wanted to go back to the startup thing. Not necessarily the same sort of crazy growth treadmill that Cosmo tried to get on. It wasn't necessarily that I think I was maybe a little burned on. But other than that, like, I always wanted to go back to startups.
All right. So you're getting press, and then the report comes to you. Did the first report you put out actually exist, or was that you testing the waters to see, do people even want this report before we create it?
Yeah, so some smaller things we would test. We'd say, hey, listen, we're looking at this trend. We think there's some interesting data. Would you be interested in covering this? And people would, you know, if they responded, yay, we knew it was. If they said no, if they didn't say anything, that was the vote of, you know, no confidence. So that smaller things we do. The big first report we did was a quarterly VC report. So we knew that PricewaterhouseCoopers and Thomson put out this report. We knew Dow Jones put out this report. We said we'll come out with our report a week to 2 weeks before them. And we'll just make it really detailed and have tons of interesting insights into what's going on. And we'll send it to all these, you know, this small but growing list of journalists. And I think it was Read Write Web back then. They were like the first ones to cover our stuff pretty regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And like that was, again, like it was just confidence building more than anything.
Internally,
right? It was just like you need momentum, right? And I think even if it's revenue is great momentum, but even if it's not revenue, it's like, hey, people actually care about what you're doing and they're finding it useful. And so that was like a good kick in the pants that, all right, somebody's finding it useful. And then we had other people reach out as a result saying, oh, I saw Read Write covered this. You know, the peers of Read Write at the time reached out and said, oh, how do I get on your list, right? And so that started getting things going. And, you know, every time we got one of those emails, like, it was a big rush, right? It was like, oh, TechCrunch reached out. They want to be on the list, right? That felt really, really good at the time. So,
do you remember one of the early reports that didn't go well, that no one wanted, so you didn't create, or that you did create and no one wanted?
So there's a couple rules we have at CBI. One is, like, when we do a report, like, we're going to do it because there's interest in it. And two, the data is always going to be right. So like we've been pretty lucky in that when we do a report, like it already has sort of interest in it. I mean, we've pitched some ideas on, I think we used to pitch a lot of ideas about what's happening in your state. Right. And we're like, oh, what's happening in Ohio venture capital. Right. And so there just aren't a lot of, and that was just picking a bad market, right? Like, there aren't a lot of people in the media in Ohio at that time that cared about venture capital. And so it just fell flat sort of naturally. And that was probably a blessing in disguise, because even if it got covered, it would have been covered by one person at a small publication.
So what about that? What if you put it out and – actually, let's not say you put it out. You said you used to test the waters.
Yeah.
I understand if no one wants it, don't create it. If people do want it, do create it. What if it's somewhere in the middle? What if it's a little bit of interest? So now there are a few people who are counting on it coming out, but not so much that it's actually worth your time to create. How do you push back and say, hey, you know this thing that I told you we were doing? Mm-mm, not going to happen.
Yeah, so that's where if we put it out there and somebody, we got a nibble, we did it. Like, we never said, oh, sorry, there wasn't, you know, like, we're not going to do it for X, Y, and Z reason. We always did it,
so
right?
So you came out with Staten Island Venture Capital Report, and you came to me, a blogger who happened to cover Staten Island Venture Capital, and I said yes, but nobody else said yes. You would go and put out that report.
We'd do that, yeah.
Why would you do that?
You know, because we're competing with these really large companies that'll take you to steak dinners and they'll take you to Yankee games and do all this great stuff. We have nothing, right? And so the only thing we have is credibility, which we can build with partners in media. And we have these potential media partners, right, who don't like the other guys either because they're not responsive or they don't like their data or whatever it is. So this was like the one unique value proposition we had, was we're going to be reliable and our data is going to be good. And if we don't deliver on the report we said we'd do, we've killed the reliability lever.
I see.
And you never saw the data, so you have no way of assessing.
So if only one person said yes, you would do it. So then that tells me that you must have been really selective about who you turned to when you were trying to figure out whether to create a report. You wouldn't go to some guy who just set up a WordPress site.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. So we'd look for, like, you know, Google News was our go-to, right? If we could see you in Google News, Twitter wasn't what it is today, so we didn't really have a good way, and there wasn't, you know, all these great tools out there that tell you what the most shared pieces of, you know, articles are. So, yeah, it was really, you know, Google News was a big part of it, or somebody finding something kind of ad hoc. But, yeah, it was conscious enough that we knew that we were looking for people who had some modest, at least, amount of reach.
All right, let's take this example of Staten Island Venture Capital.
Yeah.
Right? You now have to put this report together. You don't have friends at Staten Island Venture Capital like you did when you were putting together the credit card report. Yeah. How do you go about putting something like that together?
Yeah, so we have some data, let's say, on Staten Island Venture Capital, right? We know a couple of deals that have happened. We know a couple of the
VCs. They would just
VCs
be in your system. Invest.
It'd be in the database,
How would
right?
it be in the database? Who goes in? Who at the time went and added that data to your database?
So John and myself did it initially. So mm-hmm. we did it for the first 50,000,
right?
Talking
about Jonathan Sherry, your
Jonathan
co-founder.
Jonathan Sherry, yeah.
You guys would just be up nights just looking
manually,
online?
Yeah, we'd like read. We had probably a list of 30 different blogs and biz journals that we'd read. And every time there was a funding announcement or an exit announcement, we'd put it into a spreadsheet, very structured, you know, company invested in, who are the investors, the amount, the series, all that good stuff. We would have interns who'd help us out. So we'd get interns during Christmas break or whatever.
And just reading blogs, putting it in the spreadsheet, somebody dedupes to make sure that there's not duplicate information. Yeah. And then the spreadsheet made it into the site. How?
We built a tool to upload a spreadsheet into a SQL database.
Okay. And then where else? It's not just reading blogs. You did more. What else did you get? How else did you get more data?
It was really mostly reading blogs, right? And then we would we'd Google around, right, and say, you know, largest deals in Staten Island, top VCs in Staten Island, right? We'd look for any kind of chain, any sort of breadcrumb that might get us to a link that's interesting, and then we'd follow that till its logical end, and any new data we'd put into the spreadsheet, right? And so just kind of ground and pound, we just kept doing this over and over and over again. And then over time, we realized there's patterns in all these articles we're reading, right? It's, you know, so-and-so raises from so-and-so in a Series B for $10 million, and we said, okay, we can automate this, right? And so John and I are chemical and electrical engineers respectively, so we couldn't do that development ourselves, but we finally started building out a team, and so got some really great machine learning guys to help us actually algorithmically analyze this stuff.
When you're doing it by hand, you're starting to notice some patterns yourself. And of course, yeah, you know, we do that too internally. We're like maniacs about how do we find guests. We found you because you're a fan of Mixergy and we started talking and that led to this interview. But we have like certain phrases like acquired for. We will go and search for that like maniacs in different blogs to find a small company that was acquired and no one discovered. We go to data sources like Inc. 500 to see who rose up the Inc. 500, right? And then we add that to our system. And eventually, we do come up with phrases that anyone can use, and I can go to virtual assistant and say, here's what I want you to look for. Here are the sites we trust. I want you to put it in the system. And now here's our check to make sure that that data is actually right because it's on a blog, right? So you did that, and then that was the beginning, and then you kept growing and growing it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The best data, though, that I get is when I talk to you or talk to someone else, and they say, you know who no one talks about? It's my friend or this guy who I met at dinner who's a real jerk because he's doing so freaking well, but nobody knows about it. And he had this big smile on his face at dinner. How do you get that data into your system? How did you in the early days?
Yeah, so that's that type of data that's sort of like tribal knowledge is really hard to find, right? Mm-hmm. So we are looking for structured data that's out there somewhere in the ether, right? So it's somewhere, it's in an SEC filing, it's in some business publication, it's in a blog, it's on Kleiner Perkins' portfolio page, and we look for changes to that every day and see is there a new logo that's been added, right? So so I think that's the way we tend to surface all of this information on companies that are interesting. You know, somebody who has – we're tracking financing events, right? So somebody who's just built quietly a company that's worth a lot of money and been off the grid, we're not going to capture, right? That's going to be hard to find. But if that person gets interviewed and eventually there's an article saying, hey, Andrew's built this great company up, he's never taken money, but they just hired their 100th employee and they're going to track it, they're tracking at $50 million in revenue, like that, at that point, that company's going to be in our database. If, however, you're really just kind of camera press shy and you just are minting money kind of in this secret lair, right, we're not going to find you then.
Yeah, those are harder. I still think at some point you could get to them because success leaves clues. And I don't just mean in the Tony Robbins way. I mean, for example, what you just brought up, if someone has no funding, but they have 100 employees, that's a really good indication. Now,
absolutely.
How do you know they have 100 employees? Because LinkedIn makes that data available to you. How do you know if they're hiring a lot? Because they post ads on certain sites, and that makes it available. Is it easy? It's really hard.
Yeah.
But that stuff is out there, and I think we could all get – I can't actually because, frankly, it's too much work for me. But for a company like yours, like CB Insights, you could do that, and I could see that coming in.
Yeah, and that's what we're doing, actually. I mean, the only money we've taken is from the National Science Foundation is to solve this exact problem. So we're now crawling job boards. We're looking at web traffic, mobile app data.
Tell me about that, actually.
Media sentiment.
The National Science Foundation gave you guys money.
Yeah.
They don't take a share of your business.
No, it's a grant. So
it's a grant. And why do they want someone to go and uncover deep company, private data, data about private companies?
Yeah, so we went to them and said, listen, when the recession hits, all the banks stop lending to private companies because they don't understand private companies. So they just assume that we're all super risky. And so we said, listen, we think we can provide a more nuanced view into individual private company performance using all this exhaust that's left on the web. So we can use, you know, social media chatter and hiring and all these other signals. And as a result, people will make better decisions about how to deal with private companies. And they said, okay, that sounds interesting. They gave us, I think it was a $250K grant or $150K grant to start. Said, listen, you have a year, prove out that there's something here. We proved that out. We got another $500,000. And then we ended up getting another $500,000 from them, which is sort of the limit. So we got in total $1.15 million from the National Science Foundation. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, you know, if you know Dun & Bradstreet, right, it's sort of DNB 2.0, right? Can you build a more thoughtful, real-time way of understanding private companies? So, and that's where we're going. It's going beyond the funding and the M&A data into actual scores of private companies.
How do you even know that there's that this money is available?
So a friend of mine was a reviewer at the NSF. Like, he'd read the initial applications, and we were chatting one day, and I said, oh, we're working on this really hard problem at Amex. I saw that we never knew what was going on with private companies. And he said, hey, I don't know if it's exactly NSF material, but it sounds like a hard problem, and they like this kind of stuff. You should try to apply. So we applied. It's mostly academics who apply. And so the NSF program officer said, hey, listen, you guys don't know how to write a research proposal, but we think it's interesting what you're doing. Can you put together a PowerPoint? And, you know, we said, hey, we know PowerPoint. Like, from our corporate days, we're good at PowerPoint.
I'm sorry, let me take it back to something even more pedestrian than that. I can see once you got your foot in the door, I could see you sliding right in, and I understand the result. But the part I don't understand is the friend part.
Yeah.
Hey, you're a guy who's really busy. You don't have much time. How do you stay in touch with your friends so that you could help each other out like this? Are you guys going out for drinks? Do you just call your friends randomly and say, here's what I'm working on? What's your process for staying in touch and making your relationships pay off like this?
Yeah, so this one was just we were getting drinks. You know, he wanted to sell into the hedge fund industry, which we were no longer doing. And we were kind of exchanging notes about what we did and, you know, seeing if there was anybody I could introduce him to. And then he kind of – it was really, I think, started – the conversation was really all about, hey, what – you know, how can I help you with the hedge fund stuff we did? And I think at the end – we were talking about what we were doing, and he said, hey, this is like a flyer. Like, I have no idea if it's interesting, but give it a shot. And he made the introduction then to the NSF person. So before we put anything together, we had a call with this person saying, hey, we think we can assess private companies using these algorithms. And that guy was like, ah, that's interesting. You should apply. That was really, it was like a 10-minute conversation.
I see.
And then that was, we put together this very ornate research document that was kind of in this very specific NSF format. And then from there, they called us and said, you know, not a very good proposal, but we still think there's something here. And they kind of gave us another shot, and we ended up getting that first grant.
You told our producer, Jeremy Weiss, that the first $1.5 million in sales you did.
Yep.
You personally.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Some of it I can understand comes to you because your price was really low and because you were in the media. But at some point, you've got to go out and start pounding the pavement yourself or working the phones or whatever phrase we want to use.
Yeah.
Do you remember what your process was in the beginning when it was just you trying to figure out where the money was going to come in?
Yeah, so interestingly, the first 1.5 actually was all inbound.
All inbound?
Yeah.
So all of you just getting in the media?
Yeah, just getting in the media, and like we started to put our newsletter out a little bit more regularly, and so started just being on in people's consciousness.
Okay.
And people were signing up for a free trial, but we had a horrible – we didn't follow up. We basically let you sign up. We dumped you into the product and said, figure it out. And the product wasn't super intuitive at that time either. But some people just came to us and said, we think this is really interesting. Like, how do we pay you? Right. And so some of it was just that. Some of it was people writing in saying, hey, I want to find data on X. Can you help me? And so I'd set up a call with them and basically do like a customer support tutorial. And then while I had them, I knew the product really well. And I'd say, you know, hey, if you're a VC, you know, are you looking for deal? I just ask questions and they'd say, oh, yeah, I could use it for that too. And I could use it for that too. And whatever else came up. And then eventually, you know, some of those things turned into subscriptions to CB Insights.
What share of your business is done by venture capitalists now?
So right now we're probably only – we're kind of a third what we call deal makers. So that's the VCs, M&A folks, investment bankers. I'd say VCs are probably, you know, half of that. So let's say about 16% of our total business right now.
Yeah. All right, they're coming in, you're closing the sales, and we're talking about what, $2,000 you said, $2,500 at this point?
Yeah, so by this point, we'd already migrated up. So we were probably $15,000, $16,000 at this point.
So that's still a lot of customers coming in, and a lot of customers signing up.
Yeah, yeah. Now, we were doing well in the beginning, and you know, I knew the product, and having worked in VC, I knew the pain point. And so we were just like extremely... I wasn't the sales guy in the way I always thought of sales guys, right? I always thought of sales guys as like big watch, slick back hair, fast talker, and I was none of those, but I just knew the product. And so I could just call them up and say, hey, listen, I saw you guys did a deal in X. We have a bunch of data on that category. You know, let me show you that. And that just sort of worked. It was very consultative, and then that worked. And then finally in the end of 2013, we hired our first external
About 5 years in business, you've hired your first salesperson.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm looking here. Here's something else in my notes that was a little surprising, or I didn't understand, actually. You said to Jeremy, proof of concept slapped us in the face. We went to our payroll provider, and they told us they could not give us better pricing because of our rating. It was a 4. What does that mean?
Yeah, so in this goal to assess private companies, you know, I think it was a pain I saw at Amex. It was sort of this abstract thing, you know, oh, private companies get screwed. But I hadn't felt it firsthand. So a few years ago, we went to a payroll provider to run CBI's payroll, and we asked them for better pricing. They said, hey, you know, you're a 4 out of 5 on some credit scale, which means you're close to bankrupt. You know, I said, listen, we're far from it. We're doing really well. You know, we're growing quickly. And I think we were eight, nine employees at that time. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, listen, we use this scoring system by so-and-so big company, and there's nothing more we can do, right? And so what kind of hit me, sort of made the pain point we're trying to solve very, very kind of very clear to me at that point, which was as a result of this archaic kind of scoring system they were using, basically, this guy lost business because we were 9 people then. We're going to be 50 people soon. So he would have made some good money off of us. And we ended up wasting time going to find another payroll provider that could give us better terms. And we got worse terms from them. So that was just kind of, you know, on the entrepreneurial journey, sort of the first instance of seeing firsthand the problem we were trying to solve impact us.
It seems like you've also, through that understanding, broadened who your customer base would be. That at first it was people who were doing M&A or investing in companies in some form.
Yeah.
And then you started to discover, hey, there are all these other groups of people who need data on private companies that's more accurate than exists on the market today. When you started out, how did you know how big the market was going to be when you just thought it was going to be people who are deal makers? How did you know that it was big enough?
I don't think we spent a lot of time thinking about it, right? I thought my calculus, which wasn't very good, was, well, Dow Jones and Thomson have offerings that sell into VCs and bankers. So they're big companies. It must be a big opportunity, right? And then we realized as we were building that this actually isn't that big of an opportunity, right? Even if we sell, let's say generously there's 1,500 active VCs in the world. If we sold all of them a 30K subscription, it's a very nice business, but it's not the type of business we're aiming to go for. But I think a big part of as we were building was just listening to the types of – and seeing the types of customers signing up. So one of the first biz dev groups that signed up was Marketo, right? And so when Marketo signed up, we talked to them and said, what are you using us for? Like, we don't even understand who you guys are, right? And they said, well, we're using it to sell to private companies. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then we got Rackspace and we got a bunch of other folks and said, okay, there's this whole other use case, and sales is this giant category. Like,
because what they're trying to do is Marketo, I imagine they're a sales automation system, right?
Yep.
They're trying to figure out who is big enough to need us and also fits within the categories of companies that work with us. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And the way they do it historically was they'd go read on TechCrunch about a company that got funding, and then right after that, they'd call that company, right? And so the problem with that is that there are 600 other people calling on that company, right? And two, there's a bunch of companies that don't make it onto any of these sources. And there's ways of getting some of that data before it gets onto the mainstream sources too. So So they were looking for just an edge, ultimately, right? They wanted to fill the top of their lead funnel with as many companies as humanly possible, and that's really what we enabled them to do.
What percent of your business now is that, salespeople?
So we're about a third of our customers now are in the sort of sales, yeah.
You said, so we started seeing people like Marketo use us, and we called them up. What is your process for doing it? I don't think a lot of businesses are even aware of who are buying services from them, let alone have a process for following up and understanding.
Yeah, so we do a few things. One, we have online chat, which is like an amazing tool for understanding customers, right? So we think of online chat as basically defect reports, right? We don't want you to chat with us. But if you're going to chat with us, you're probably chatting with us because you're telling us something's not working or something's not as intuitive as it should be. Or you're asking a question about how you can use our data in a way that we haven't thought of. So chat's been really, really useful for us. And then a lot of it is we'll just reach out to people now and ask questions, right? So I think a lot of our customer discovery is, what are you trying to do? And they'll give us very specific guidelines, and we'll figure out we're not a great tool for that. But if we get enough people asking us for that, that tells us we should probably build that, right? And so our entire roadmap, we have sort of some incremental things that we're trying to do, is all driven by customer questions. And then we have some game changer things that we want to do that are really more driven by our vision for where this space needs to go. Mm-hmm. But I think asking questions and being really open to those ideas has been really important for us. Like, we don't say no to anything, right? We'll say, yeah, that's interesting. Let us come back to you. Let's talk to the dev team and see if we can do it. We say no a lot after that conversation, but in the beginning, like, we're extremely open to feedback and ideas. And then if it sounds like it's just some one-off need that nobody else will ever have, that's when we'll say, hey, sorry, we can't do it. But if we think it's interesting, we'll talk to a few other customers and say, hey, if we built this, would this make your life easier? Would it solve, would you get rid of another vendor that you're using right now and just use us?
That's an interesting question, because you're not going to sell it for, your subscription stays the same, but you still need to know, do they care about it enough to want us to keep building it up? And it's not just a nice to have that they'll never look at. And so the way you figure that out is saying, by asking, will you get rid of another vendor if we add this?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I mean,
we want to keep taking more parts of the value chain, right? Like, we want to keep owning more of it. And, you know, in our business, it's all about retention. Like, that's, you know, acquisition's important. It's sexy. But, like, the way we're going to build a giant business is by, like, having crazy retention. And so talking to them frequently has been a really key part of that. I think, you know, enterprises aren't used to, that's who we sell into, they're not used to vendors actually like giving a crap. And so, like, when somebody makes a recommendation on build, hey, Anand or John or whoever, can you build this in the product? And they see it in the next 3 months or the next 6 months, like, that's like, you pretty much have a fan for life at that point. So that's been really important.
I blew past something that you mentioned earlier, but I know it's important because I've talked to your competitors about it, and I even see it in my pre-interview notes from your conversation with Jeremy. The newsletter. The newsletter is something that people value more than they value your competitors. It's free.
Yeah.
It's got a certain attitude to it. The first one you say sucked or wasn't good. What was it about what was in the first one, and why wasn't it good?
Yeah, so I think the main thing was I had this view of corporations that you had to talk to corporations in a certain way, mm-hmm. right? Which was be very businesslike, right? So use very sort of robotic, big words like, you know, leverage and synergy
right.
and value add and win-win.
I would imagine that's true too.
Yeah. And so I thought that that was what people in corporations like to hear. And so the first newsletter just was void of any personality. It was good data with zero that nothing that really made it interesting. And so then kind of we started being a little edgier, right? And, you know, we track Silicon Valley and its kind of brethren. And there's a lot of amazing companies and there's a lot of just silly stuff that happens in the Valley. And we sort of just said, we're just going to call a spade. And when something funny happens, we'll mention it. And we might throw in pop culture references or hip hop
references.
One
of the first references that you made that made you feel like, you know, this is a little dangerous. We could lose our credibility if we make a reference to Biggie Smalls or to what?
Yeah, it was actually Biggie that we made a reference to. It was some lyric of his that we put into a newsletter, right? And I think our concern was, it was that, and then we actually put out a post saying, VCs are not good predictors of technology success, mm-hmm. right? And so, like, I remember there was a lot of debate internally, because the data basically said that. And there was a lot of debate internally, like, hey, do you really want to say this because these are our potential customers, right? And we kind of made the call that, listen, we're, like, there's so much like sugar-coated kind of garbage out there that we should just be – we're not trying to – we have no axe to grind in this whole thing. Like, mm-hmm. if there's good news, we're going to report great stories. If there's bad news, we'll report those. And we put it out. And the feedback, one, that went kind of viral because it was just provocative. But two, the feedback from VCs was, hey, it's like we love that like somebody's actually saying this, right? Like they really – like most
they like
of them
it.
Liked it. Yeah, they liked it. They were just like – because, you know, they're like, yeah, we know this, but nobody ever says this kind of stuff, right? And so, today in the newsletter, we talk about entrepreneurs who think, like, startups are heroic and courageous, and we kind of call them out.
Why?
Right? It's one, I think most founders are middle to up, middle class and up, have pretty good educational backgrounds. So they have fallback plans, right? They have a safety net or they can go get a job. And so I think like this narrative of startups as this noble, heroic thing that people do is just a little it's a little too self-important, right?
I agree with you about that. I've got to tell you. I mean, it's okay that yeah. we don't agree, but yeah. I have to say, here's why.
Yeah.
I see how deep depression runs. There's if you have so much to lose and such a big sense of self, and then you watch it literally just disappear. I mean, really, in the reality, it's not just a yeah. mental thing. You see it disappear. It's hugely painful. You mentioned the stress that you had with your wife. Other people's wives and husbands are not that understanding, and it causes dramatic tension that causes relationships to break up. It's huge. Sure. When you think about why people fight as couples, money is number one. Losing status for a man in today's world could be worse than losing money. And that sense of devastation that comes from that has deeper impact than you could imagine. I think it's more than that. I think we ride things all the way to the bottom. You can say to someone who takes $10,000 to Vegas, hey, you know what? You could always stop once you hit 1,000 and you have 1,000. But once you get in that game, it's hard
yeah,
to stop
hard
when
to
you're
stop.
Down 1,000. You go
yeah.
below that because that's the mindset that you come in there with. You are not going to let up. How many people were not going to let up and took it too far? There's so many different things. And then the upside, I think, is really heroic. When I look at how many people are now, let's have a look right now at how many people you've employed. How many people now are getting to go home and get a job because of CB Insights? Now, did you save them from a burning fire? No. But if you only have to save someone from a burning fire if you're a hero, I think then we're overestimating
sure.
what it takes to be heroic. So I see it. I see the power of it. But I also understand what you're going for. You're trying to be the person who comes up with ideas that are different from what we believe in, and I like that you're challenging us. But
yeah. So I think that's been one of the things that's been the growth of the newsletter. It went from 25,000 to just crossed 78,000 today in the last year has been a function of having a viewpoint, right? I think that's been the key thing that we learned.
Do you turn like – I guess I'm now completely disagreeing with you on that, but I'm not going to lose respect for you or anything. I'm not going to step away from working with you guys, not that we do work together. Yeah. I guess is it fair to say that all this – that the worry is just overblown too, that you could be controversial and all the things you worried would happen are just not going to?
Yeah, I mean, I think we know what is completely over the line, right? And we're not going to cross that line. But I think trying to be everybody's friend yields nobody really caring about you, right? Like, I would like people to have an opinion on us, right? So I think that's the key thing, right? So you may not like some of the things we put out, but I want to be in your consciousness.
Yeah, right? Because even if I disagree with you, I know the way it happens. Now, in this case, I'm going to put it out of my mind and think, hey, that's interesting. I could have been a little bit more articulate about what I said, but there are also some ideas that I uncovered by pushing back on camera that I should remember and use again. But if I wasn't going to interview you and I did just read something like that and I disagreed with it, it would be in my head just echoing because I wouldn't have an outlet until I talked to someone else. And then I would want it even echoing more in my head because I'd have to sharpen the argument for the next time I got it. And that's what you go for when you say controversial, not you personally, but that's what people go for when they say controversial things. They want the headspace. They want that consideration that goes on a lot. And it happens much more when someone disagrees than when they do agree.
Yeah, and I think the other big thing is, you know, this example was a little bit of an outlier. Most of our stuff is very data-driven, right? So in the case of the VCs aren't good predictors of tech success, it was looking at the exits over time and saying that basically it's 20 VCs that have all the exits, right? So while, like, everybody talks about investing in billion-dollar companies, the vast majority of you don't, right? And it was just like, here's the data, right? So most of it is very data-driven, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what – and it's sort of indisputable. So I think that's the other thing that's been really good is that, hey, you guys have this viewpoint, but you've proven it out with data, right? And it's not like, you know, we have
OKCupid is the model. OKCupid used to put out.
OKCupid is our model. Is exactly it. It's like we have a blog post, I think, where we say we're OKCupid for VCs, right? Like that was, you know, them. They were the first, right? And then I'd look at like, you know, guys like HubSpot, they do a really good job. You know, I really like what Noah Kagan does, you know, obviously in a very different space. But, like, there's been a bunch of sort of content role models that we have. The OKCupid, by far, is, like, right up top.
Sam Yagan, past Mixergy interviewee, talked about that. And the model was to say, we have all this data because people are interacting with our site. They're finding dates. Let's find a way to create interesting articles based on that data. What kind of look gets more dates? What kind of person gets more messages? Hey, one more thing about offending.
Yeah.
You used to send out this email to people that says, three reasons you didn't respond to me. One is I offended you. The second one is maybe someone wooed you. And the third is you were trapped under a rock.
Right.
Who did you send that out to and what was the response?
So this is to prospects that I had a really good conversation with that just went cold. Right. And so, you know, there's times when you leave a demo and you say, you know, every use case they came up with, I nailed. We talked about the pricing page, right? We had everything was like, it looked like this was just going to happen. And then, you know, they got busy with life and other challenges and ended up not, you know, a couple emails sent. Hey, let's do a call to touch base. Let's figure out next steps. Nothing happened. And so there's a point that we reach where we just send this email. And it was just sort of like, out of pure desperation. We're like, nobody's responding. Like these people who are clearly interested, because, and then we can see if they've tried to log in after their trial. So we know they hit a limit. So we're like, something's just off, right? And so I'd send this email, basically with those three choices, right? And, you know, the thing for us is the worst place to be is in limbo. Like I ideally want you as a customer, or two, I just want you to say no. Right, I just don't want to be in the middle, right? Because the middle just requires, like you said earlier, of the earlier example, it just requires you to be in my head, right? I have to start thinking, like, did I screw that up? Did I like not follow up? Did I not send them a curated feed that was interesting to them? If you just say no, I went, like, we decided we're just going to Google around and not buy a platform, fine.
That's like, helpful, because now you know what your competition is. That's Google. Yeah. They're Google. All right. And so this email, a little bit edgy, a little creative and funny, got you the response from people, and at least they were able to say no.
Yeah, and actually, almost, I would say 90% of the time, they say, sorry, I fell off the map. We're still really interested. I just got roped into a project. Here's our procurement guy. Here's my analyst. Like, that just gets the ball rolling.
Anand, I got to ask you more about this. I know we're really over time here, but I still need to ask you this, because I've asked you about what your sales process is, and you said it's inbound. And maybe the first 1.5 was starting inbound, but as you're talking, I'm seeing all these different indicators that you have a system and had it even before you hired people. Things like curated feed of articles that you would send people. That's not something that you happen to do. That's a process. I'm going to get curated feeds of articles that I could send to prospects as a way of warming them up. This email that you send to them to get them to say yes or no, that's part of a process. What was your process for getting strangers to buy your service when you told our producer in the beginning it wasn't especially good? What was the process?
And so I'd say a lot of these developments, Andrew, have been all within the last year. In the last year. So what we've done now is, when you sign up, we send you a drip marketing campaign, right? Okay. And it's really trying to get you back into the platform. And when you onboard, we ask you a few questions. Are you interested in Silicon Valley and tech? And, you know, try to get a sense for what you're interested in. And then the drips are basically all created based on what you say you're interested in. So if you said Silicon Valley tech, we're not going to send you Massachusetts biotech deals. And we send you a series of emails over the course of the next 10 days, right? Each with a different, trying to highlight a different facet of CB Insights, but that also are very much in line with giving value, right? So we don't ask for the sale a lot, right? It's always, here's a free report, here's some companies that we think would be interesting.
Here's our newsletter that's especially fun.
Yeah. And then sort of towards the tail end of that drip, we'll say, hey, can we get on a demo? You know, it looks like you've been coming back. It looks like you're getting value. Then we get you on a demo. Nobody's going to spend $35,000 just by putting their credit card down. So we have to get you on a demo. We have to get you and your colleagues we open up the trial a bit more, let you play around with it. And so that drip marketing is a big part of what we've been kind of perfecting.
I see. Did you learn how to do that? This whole idea of sorting people out it's not a natural idea.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think we've benefited a lot because there's a lot of very generous people on the web who share this kind of expertise, right? People we've probably seen on your show, you know, we'll look at what folks like HubSpot are doing, or just people that we admire, and we'll pick up elements of what they do that we think are really, really solid. And we'll try to, you know, kind of mirror them or replicate them for our circumstances. So, you know, we borrow, you know, shamelessly from other people. And I think that's been a big thing. You know, there's a lot of people in the online marketing realm who are very, very open about their strategies and things. And so, you know, I think oftentimes they have more of a consumer mindset, but I think what we found is a lot of things that work for the consumer space, if we can just turn them a little bit, they work really well for B2B as well. And so drip marketing was one thing, you know, looking at what's it called? Shopping cart abandonment, right? So we don't have that because we don't have a shopping cart. But if we see you looking at our pricing page and you haven't taken a demo, that's the equivalent of abandonment for us.
See. What's your software that you use to keep track of that?
What do we use? Our stack's pretty crazy right now.
I know. I'm trying to like hunt down all the page source. I can see that you guys are using Google retargeting. I could see all the basic stuff, but
yeah, I think we use Intercom is one of the tools that we use, which lets us do kind of in-app messaging really well. Mm-hmm. So that's been really good. Instapage for some of the kind of pages that we spin up. What else do we use? MailChimp. I don't know how we do that last part.
There are a few tools that do that.
Yeah.
Marketo does that.
Yeah. Part of this is, I think, because we've been, you know, revenue funded, as we like to say. We've been we built a lot of stuff in-house that probably, looking back, we should have just gotten a vendor to do for us. Mm-hmm. But we were so conscious of expense in the beginning,
so
and we still are.
So it's easier to code it up than commit
yeah,
to-
we just develop it ourselves. You know, I think we've sort of started to buy specialist software more now that we have a little bit more, you know, we're not worried about going, you know, meeting payroll. But, you know, back in the day, it was like, well, let's just build it ourselves. So I think a lot of the stuff we do have is pretty homegrown.
What's your revenue now?
We don't disclose. Well, you know, we're in the high single-digit millions.
High single. So we're talking about 5 to 10 million.
Yeah.
And you're profitable.
Yeah, always been.
Over a million in profit?
So we plow it all back into the company.
Yeah, I guess right? Of course so, you do. So I guess what I'm wondering is, what kind of a cushion do you keep for yourself? It's for stability, since you're basically out there on your own right now.
Yeah, so we can't hire as quickly as we'd like to right now. So we probably have a year and a half of burn in the bank, just because assuming like nobody renews and we closed no new sales and we kept the exact same team, we'd be good for another year and a half. But you know, if we could grow the sales team, we're going to be at 9. If I could grow it to 20 tomorrow, I'd grow it to 20. If I could grow a content team from 6 to 12 tomorrow, we'd grow it to 12. So we just can't hire fast enough right now. Like we, you know.
So why aren't you raising money?
I don't have religion on this. I think, you know, I left Amex to be my own boss, and I like the idea of growing it our way. We get inbound interest relatively frequently. We may do it a little bit down the road. There's a couple nuggets or a couple elements of the sales process that I really want to nail in terms of making it. I want to make it McDonald's, right? Where like just you know just put this in and this comes out. There's a couple aspects of it that we're still not where I think we need to be. Once we get there, then it'll be time to potentially raise money, because then it just is, we can scale this thing to, you know, to the moon.
Yeah, I get what you're doing. Well, it's a phenomenal business. It's so cool to see how much you've grown and to hear the story of how you got here. Yeah, wait, one more thing. How do you guys use Mixergy? You've mentioned that you and people on the team at CB Insights use Mixergy. How do you guys use it?
Yeah, so I think the big ones are the things that you have around marketing, right? So people who talk about customer acquisition, right, or media probably are the two kinds of interviews that probably – do the best. And then I think recently you did something about interviewing, right?
Yeah, like how my interview process.
Yeah. And so some of the guys on the team, we sort of are experimenting with the idea of a podcast. And so I sent it to them. I said, like, if you really want to do this, you need to learn how to interview. And like, you should learn what Andrew does, because he's good at it. And so I think they're, I don't know if it's a course or class or video or whatever. I think they're like, looking at it, or you know, potentially going to be doing that. So, but I'd say the customer acquisition marketing things that you have are probably the most interesting to us.
Like where Jermaine Griggs says that he teaches people how to play piano by listen by ear. He will ask people who come to his site, "What kind of music do you want to play? Do you want to play gospel or rock and roll?" And then drip out different emails based on the style of music they're into, so he can talk to their interest instead of being generic. And it seems like you've brought those kind of customer marketing techniques.
I think the other thing we've actually learned from you are just your emails. So we just did a webinar, and you always do that, you know, in this you're going to learn 1, 2, and 3. Mm. So we, like, our webinar template was very much modeled after that, right? Because otherwise we tend to, like, get into the weeds on the data a little bit, because, like, we're data geeks and we love that. But, you know, I think what you do when you make it all about the user or the listener, right? That was sort of the ethos we tried to go for on the webinar. So I think those emails are just interesting, right? We'll just forward it around and say, like, hey, look at how they spun this into the benefit, which is really cool.
Yeah, we keep experimenting with ours, and it's really cool to know that you guys are watching it and that you're listening and that you're getting stuff out of it. Because I've gotten into so many conversations about CB Insights. Unlike other businesses, you speak directly to people in the startup, investor, tech scene. It's one of those businesses that no one expected to do well, because frankly, no one no one knew about you guys in the tech community. You weren't on the cover of TechCrunch, on the homepage of TechCrunch talking about how you just raised $10 million.
Yep.
You weren't at all the parties. You're just a guy who was sitting heads down, working like mad, and built this thing up. And it's really inspiring to see. Built this tool up that so many people in our space now are watching.
Cool, appreciate
all right. Anand, thank you so much for doing this interview.
You.
Congratulations on the success. The website, of course, is cbinsights.com.
Cool. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for the time.
Thank you all for being a part of it. Bye, everyone.